Hi, folks. This is Bob Main. Welcome to another episode of today's Survival Show, helping you do what you can with what you have wherever you are. This is episode number 171. This is a practical, no tin foil hat type of show. I don't like to go off into these big conspiracy theories and things like that. That's not my style. There's other places you can get that kind of stuff. I'm not into that. I just keep it rooted in common sense. I'm an everyday guy. And I just talk about what it is that I'm trying to do to get prepared. So, as if you've been following the show recently, you know that I've been putting out a call to people who listen to this show or people who are on the forum to help contribute some information to this show. I think it's good that you don't always hear from me. I have a lot of ideas in my head. There's a lot of things I'd like to do. I've kind of reevaluated and figured out how to make the time to continue this podcast, at least on a weekly basis, maybe once every week to 10 days or so. That'll fly. One of the things that's helping me a lot is you folks contributing material. So today we have a show on backup heat, and it's contributed by a gentleman named A Gray Man from the forum. That's his username, A Gray Man. And one of the things that he and I have in common is that he lives in rural Wisconsin. Well, guess what? I was raised in rural Wisconsin. Born in New York City, raised in rural Wisconsin. That's a long story I'll tell you about some other day. Now I live in the great state of Texas. I'm in San Antonio, the Alamo City. Anyway, A Gray Man sent me this audio clip, and it's a terrific podcast in and of itself about heating his home and how to have backup sources of heat. It's wonderful. I'll tell you what, I wish that me and my family would have known some of this stuff when we were growing up in Wisconsin. We did a pretty good job of heating our home in the cold weather. And since it's the middle of winter right now, this may hit home for a lot of you who live in northern climates where it's pretty cold right now. We did a pretty good job of heating our home when I was growing up. We didn't think of everything that A Gray Man talks about in this podcast. So I think you're really going to enjoy it immensely. I'm not going to waste any more time. Here you go. Thank you very much, A Gray Man, for sending this in. And you know what? There's not going to be a conclusion that I'm going to dictate for this show. So as soon as he's done with this podcast, you'll hear the music that'll close out the show. Just say this before I turn his podcast on. Consider an investment in my Survival Champions Club podcast. For only $15, you get a customized podcast, and there's a lot of great survival information on there, interviews with plenty of different people on quite a few different subjects. Go to todayssurvival.com, click the Survival Champions Club podcast link. You can see what it's all about. Your $15 will help support my show and help keep it going. It's a customized podcast, information I've never covered on this show before, exclusively for people who become members of the Survival Champions Club, and it's only $15 per episode that I record. I usually release one about once every 3 or 4 months. Check it out at todayssurvival.com. Without further ado, here you go. From the forum and a listener to the show, thank you very much, sir, for sending this in. This is A Gray Man. Stay tuned.
Hi, folks. A Gray Man from the boards here. I am taking advantage of Bob's generosity and trying to fill Bob's shoes, if only for an episode, with a podcast here. Hopefully give Bob a chance to recharge his batteries and get back on track and do all the great things that he does for us. You know, 170 episodes, that's a lot of work. In preparing for this one episode, I have come to realize that it's not easy to get on here and talk for half an hour, 45 minutes. Sometimes Bob goes for an hour. And there's a lot of research that goes into it, and you definitely need to have a gift. A little bit about me. I live in rural Wisconsin. I have one wife, one dog, two kids, two cats, and 5 chickens. I'm not really much of a public speaker. You know, Bob is a salesman, and I think that experience has taught him to be a little glib, a little good with words, and never at a loss for anything to say. If you go to a party with Bob and me, I think Bob will be the center of attention, and I will be the guy trying to hide behind the potted plant in the corner. But with that having been said, let's move on. podcast topic that I've chosen is heating options. You know, there's a lot of podcasters whom I listen to, Bob and Jack Spierko, and there's the other gentleman on YouTube who lives in Florida. Anyway, these southern guys sometimes, I think, give short shrift to the importance of heating. And so this Wisconsin boy is going to jump in and try and address some of that topic for our southern friends and for folks who live up in the northern climes as well. Heat is a big concern when it gets cold, obviously. You know, they say the 3 weeks without food, the 3 days without water, I think you'd be lucky to survive 3 hours without adequate protection when it gets below zero, as it does around here sometimes. So it's a big concern to those of us who live and work in that kind of climate. Most people heat their homes with liquefied propane, or LP, natural gas, fuel oil, or electric heat. Most of the times, if you're on LP, which I am here at my rural home, I have a 500-gallon LP tank. Some larger users, maybe they have a shop to heat as well, they'll have a 1,000-gallon tank. Natural gas is piped in. Fuel oil is very similar to diesel fuel. It's delivered by truck. It's so similar to diesel fuel, in fact, that before this current generation of diesel cars that require the ultra-low sulfur diesel, some folks would get, shall we say, a bargain by using home heating oil in their diesel vehicles and not paying the road tax on it. Big trouble if you got caught, but some folks did it anyway. Lastly, electrical power. Electrical power comes from, as you guys are probably aware, the coal-fired plants, the hydroelectric plants, the nuclear plants. Electric heat is expensive if you heat a lot with it, but for just occasional use, usually the cost is not too horribly prohibitive, although, at least in our area, the cost of electricity is going up quite a bit. So, what happens if the grid goes down? What happens if we cannot rely on some of the institutions that we have come to rely on? What if the lights go out, shall we say? Well, if you have anything but electric, you may have a little bit of hope. You know, you've got LP in your LP tank. The natural gas system is actually pretty redundant. Although natural gas comes from far away, Canada in some instances, it requires a series of compressors to keep the gas flowing to your furnace. And the designers of that system have done a smart thing, and most of the pump stations are fueled by the very natural gas that they're moving along. So it's either a compressor turbine or a reciprocating engine. It's essentially a giant car or truck engine. At any rate, they burn the natural gas that's in the pipeline. So most of the natural gas systems are pretty redundant, unless you have a break in the command and control system, shall we say, or a break in the actual pipe itself. Most of the time, you're going to have natural gas flowing. Fuel oil, as I said, is pretty similar to diesel fuel. You've got a tank of it, you should know how much is in there. So the problem is how to get that furnace running. We can accomplish this with a generator or a large enough battery bank and an inverter. Here at the Grayman homestead, I have killed the breaker to my furnace. I have cut the electrical line going to the furnace, and I have put in place a male and female plug. Obviously, the male part of the plug goes to the furnace, and the female goes to my breaker box. So it's just like an extension cord. If the power goes out, I can set my generator well outside, run an extension cord through a crack in the window, and plug my furnace into my generator. The problem is I don't have one of those fancy Honda, you know, inverter generators that that is the eco throttle. That is, when my furnace fan isn't going, when the valves aren't opening to allow liquefied propane into the combustion chamber, there's very little or no current draw. One of those little Hondas that can sense that and turn its throttle down and just wait for a load, I bet you could run for a week on 5 gallons of gas. They just do a tremendous job of saving gas that way. And you know, there's really not a whole lot on the furnaces. You've got the blower. Some of our fancier furnaces have a little electronic brain that the Hondas are perfect for powering. So it really doesn't take very much power, but you need something. And that holds true for both LP or fuel oil or natural gas. We need some electricity to get the furnace going. So that's probably the best way to go about it. You can heat your entire home that way. You don't have to hole up and tack blankets up over doorways so whatever emergency heat you have stays where the living area is. It's certainly much more comfortable for long term, maybe a little bit more impractical unless you're really set up to do that. Let's look at a little bit of a lower cost backup. First on the list of kind of information I've compiled is LP heaters. And the one that sticks out in my mind, at least first of all, is the Mr. Heater Big Buddy. I don't know if you folks have seen these. It's a combustion chamber in front. It works on propane cylinders, so the 1 pound cylinders that power a lantern or a propane cook stove, just the 1 pound little cylinders will plug into each side. It's got a space for two of them. The specs say it puts out 1800 BTU, which heats, they say, about 400 square feet. So a decent sized living room. They can be used indoors. They do not, or they are not supposed to, put off carbon monoxide, which is, of course, a poisonous gas. These units have a built-in oxygen sensor. Although they don't put out a poisonous gas, they do use oxygen to burn the propane. It does have a battery or a DC-powered fan, which is kind of nice to move the warm air around in that 400 square feet. They can also be attached to your 20-pound LP tanks. Now, these 20-pound LP tanks are the same size that we usually run propane grills off of, and it can run on two of those. The run time depends, of course, on how heavily you are using it. The specs say that if you're running 2 1-pound cylinders, the little guys, it will go from 3 to 12 hours. The 2 20-pound tanks will run the heater for 50 to 220 hours. So, what's the downside of this little guy here? Well, the problem is you are not supposed to have LP tanks inside your home. If you can put your LP tanks outside and run the hose through a window to the heater itself, and maybe stuff a little insulation or a towel or something in that window crack to keep too much cold air from coming in, that would be just fine. The problem is the manufacturers of the 20-pound LP tanks are concerned about LP leaking from the tank and igniting perhaps when you're asleep and too asleep to smell it. So that's generally frowned upon as a no-no. In my research, I have heard from other survivalists and preparedness folks who say, well, if I decide to run it inside, I know that LP tanks, at least the 20-pounders, have a double seat. So if you are going to run them inside, you need to make sure the valve is all the way open, because that seals off any leakage around the valve stem. I don't know how much stock to put in that. It's probably a bad idea to run a propane tank inside your home. whether you have the LP tank inside your home or outside your home, it's probably a good idea, even in normal times, to have a few safety devices. I'm talking about a carbon monoxide detector. Probably wouldn't hurt to have one or two of these guys. The more inexpensive ones use a cartridge that can eventually degrade over time. The more expensive plug-in battery backup units generally don't have that expendable cartridge, and so they last a little bit longer. They cost quite a bit more as well. Certainly a smoke detector, you need one for every level of your home. We personally have one outside of all the bedrooms at the Grayman homestead. Fire is certainly not a good thing. If you're going to be using LP appliances inside the house, whether the tank is inside or out, it might behoove you to pick up a gas detector. These are not inexpensive, but they can smell LP when you're asleep and set off an alarm. So that's the big buddy. It's relatively inexpensive. It's pretty close to $100. The next one on the list is the blue flame or vent-free heaters. These are also LP-powered. They're usually, you can think of them as the big buddy's big brother. These fellas can put out approximately 30,000 BTU, which will heat about 1,000 square feet. They're not that expensive, about $200. Procom is a big name that you'll see a lot when you go searching for these things, but there's certainly others. They rely upon complete combustion to not make carbon monoxide. So when we get carbon monoxide from combustion of natural gas or propane or anything else, what's happening is the fuel is not being completely burned. These ventless or vent-free heaters supposedly are so efficient that you don't get that incomplete combustion. Instead of carbon monoxide, you get carbon dioxide, which is the same things we breathe out, and water vapor, or H2O. And this can be pretty substantial. These heaters go in full bore at putting out 30,000 BTUs. In 1 hour, they will put about a liter of water, I think 900 cc's of water, into the air. So it gets a little damp. Sometimes in the wintertime up north here, the air is dry anyway, so that can be helpful. But if you go for 8 or 12 hours with these things going, you may have to worry about a little bit more air exchange just to dry the air out a little bit. The vent-free heaters usually need at least 100-pound LP tank to go. Because they use so much gas, the propane in the tanks is liquefied. As the pressure decreases, it comes out of a liquid and actually becomes gas. It essentially boils at cold temperatures, and we're burning the gas. So we need enough liquid and enough surface area to produce the gas to run the heaters. They also need a regulator. You can't just stick a hose from your Procom blue flame heater out the window and hook it up to one of these 100-pound tanks. You need to have a regulator to bring the pressure down to what the heater can use. Because this is a little bit more complicated, you may need some professional help, or at least some competent help, to install these things. Now, you can make them portable and store them away until you need them, but you probably need to have some system in place because it's not as easy as just throwing it together and firing the thing off. Like the Big Buddy heater, these blue flame heaters have an oxygen sensor. Again, they don't produce carbon monoxide, but they do use oxygen in the room. They've got a little sensor, and when the oxygen level gets below a certain point, the heater will shut itself off. These heaters, so far at this point, do not require electricity to work, which is exactly why we're interested in them. Most of the ProCom ones especially are switchable very easily between propane and natural gas. Certainly, we want the standard carbon monoxide detectors and gas detectors and smoke detectors if we are going to be running things inside. Now, I had the opportunity to look at a friend's setup. A friend lives in a rural area such as I do, and he has an unfinished basement, and he has got the black pipe, the iron pipe containing the LP, leading down to his furnace. Usually there's a little pigtail that sticks down from a run of vertical black pipe that carries propane, so any little gunk or grit or whatever that gets in the pipe will fall down to the bottom of this pigtail, and the intake for the furnace itself comes off at a 90 degree angle. So the sediment falls down and the gas goes sideways, and you don't get grit in your very expensive furnace. Well, my friend put another T on the end of that pigtail, so he made another 90 degree that came off. He put a valve, and he put a little nipple on there, and he was able to connect at his leisure his Blue Flame furnace to this in sort of a temporary manner, using the piping that was already in place to run his LP furnace. So if he was not able to run his furnace with electricity, he was at least able to keep all of the piping that was actually under that part of the house, keep it from freezing, which us northern folks know that can sometimes happen, and water expands when it freezes, and you get pipes bursting, and it's very expensive. So that was his setup. He did not have it professionally installed, and he said, I know I'm taking a risk here, but I think the risk is worth it. And I patted him on the back, and I said, good luck. So the next step that we can take is a direct vented heater. Again, this does not need power to run. It is a vented heater. They're available for liquefied propane or natural gas. They're more expensive. The 30,000 BTU models is about $800 versus the $200 for the vent-free heaters. The advantages are it doesn't put any humidity in the air, and it doesn't use any oxygen from inside the house. It draws its combustion air from outside the house. I think you can see where we're going. If it's a vented heater and uses air from outside, we're going to need to put a hole in the wall of our house to run the exhaust and the air intake. And it turns out it's not a small hole, usually about a 9 1/4 inches. I don't know about you, but if somebody said, why don't you cut a hole in the side of your house about 9 1/2 inches around, that would make my heart skip a beat or two. And these definitely need to be installed by somebody who knows what they're doing. And again, the standard caveats apply. You need a CO detector and a smoke detector and all that other kind of safety stuff if you're going to be running these inside. They're very safe. I used to live in Alaska, and a lot of the places, even commercial places, relied on these little guys to provide heat in the areas that they needed it. The next option that we're going to look at is kerosene heaters. Usually, when winter rolls around, at least up here in the north, you will see these little squat tower-looking kerosene heaters that are covered with a wire cage so nobody accidentally bumps into this thing, because it's about 1,000,000 degrees, nobody wants to get branded by them. They are relatively inexpensive. They run about $100. They do not use any kind of pressurized fuel. It's kerosene. You can carry it in a bucket, and not that you would want to, but it's relatively easy and uncomplicated, and you don't need piping. The 1.5 gallon tanks that they usually have last about 12 hours or so, depending on the model. What I'm going to be talking from here on out is usually the 23,000 BTU models. One of the disadvantages to the kerosene heaters is you can't easily adjust the heat level up or down. For them to be safe, they have to run at pretty much all out. Or if you try to throttle them back and lower that wick a little bit down, you're going to run into some problems. You're going to get smoke, you're going to get smell, you're going to get incomplete combustion. And with incomplete combustion comes, of course, carbon monoxide. So we need to set these up and let her rip. If Under those conditions, when they're operating as they're supposed to, they're just as safe as the Blue Flame heaters or the Big Buddies. They're not supposed to be putting any kind of carbon monoxide into the room. Now, they will stink a little bit, especially when you start them up and shut them down. When they're up to operating temperature, they usually don't smell hardly at all. I had a shop that I built in a corner of my grandfather's pole shed when I was a young lad, built out of 2-inch styrofoam sheets. I made kind of a little workshop cave that I could work in the back, and I used a kerosene heater exactly like the ones I'm talking about. And sure enough, when I started the thing up, it just about smoked me out of there with the smell. But once it got up to operating temperature, I could hardly tell it was going, except I was nice and toasty, and it was, you know, 15 degrees outside. As I mentioned, they run about 12 hours, and I guess I misspoke there. It's 2 gallons of kerosene, the tank usually is. Run about 12 hours on 2 gallons of kerosene. Kerosene prices, however, they're no bargain. Around our parts, we're paying probably $4.25 the last time I saw. Luckily, these things sip fuel, and if you're only using them for a relatively short term, a couple weeks at most, it won't break the bank usually to lay up 20 gallons or so. It's not cheap, certainly, but it's not cost prohibitive, especially if you buy in fits and starts. It's really a bad idea to fuel these inside. Even in the corner of the pole shed where my shop was, you know, it was not a lot of fun to try and refill this thing. No matter how careful you were, no matter how well you used that siphon, you always got that smelly kerosene either on your hands or on the floor. And, you know, heaven forbid that you're trying to do this on a carpet, you'll never get the smell out of there. So that is one of the downsides. There is a gentleman who is pretty much the guru when it comes to kerosene heaters. His name is Miles Stair, like you walk up the stairs. He has a website. Actually, Miles is a survival preparedness kind of guy as well. His second website is called the End Times Report. Lots of good information there. But his main business and how Miles makes his living is selling replacement wicks for all kinds of kerosene heaters. He's got lots of free articles and information, and boy, if you're at all interested, check Miles's site out. It's really got a lot of information. Again, keep children, flammables, drunkards away from the kerosene heaters while they're going. Smoke detectors, O2 detectors, CO detectors, because it's a disaster, is not the time to slack on safety. We can make a bad situation even worse with a burn or with some carbon monoxide. Let's look at a little bit of longer-term backup heat solutions. The one that springs immediately to mind is wood. It is relatively simple to cut down trees and cut them into small pieces and let those pieces dry out and put them in a box and burn it, and all the smoke goes outside, hopefully, and all the heat stays inside. There is a huge variety of wood stoves configurations out there. I'm going to talk first about the indoor wood stoves. And immediately we run into a branch. Do you want a plate steel wood stove that's bolted together, or do you want a soapstone wood stove? This is a stove that the majority of it is 1.25-inch thick soapstone, which will stand up to expansion and contraction. And that stone holds heat, so you build a fire, and the stone is kind of slower to warm up, but it stays hot a lot longer. Now, those steel stoves, they get hot right away, and they cool off pretty quickly, too, when the fire goes out. It's hard to cook on the top of a soapstone stove. It's relatively easy to cook on a steel stove. So there's lots of decisions that need to be made. If you already have a fireplace, fireplaces are notoriously inefficient. They're very, you know, they're almost more trouble than they're worth if you're trying to heat a house with a standard traditional fireplace, which is, you know, sort of a hole in the wall with a hole going up. You know, it's you're having all the work of a wood stove, but you're getting a fraction of the heat. Well, some smart fella invented essentially a wood stove that slides into that hole and uses the chimney of the fireplace as the chimney of the wood stove. This is called a fireplace insert, and they're much, much, much more efficient than a regular fireplace. Granted, they're not as visually appealing, but I think there's a certain appeal of being warm when it's cold outside as well. The other kind of decision to make is an EPA stove versus a non-EPA stove. Back in the, I don't remember exactly the year, I believe it was the early 90s, the Environmental Protection Agency set new rules for how efficient wood stoves had to be. Now, if you go down to Tractor Supply or Menards is the big store around here, you can pick up a Vogel Zhang, essentially metal box with four legs that is a non-EPA stove. They got a waiver. They call it something else. It's not technically a wood stove, I guess. And you don't need to buy an EPA stove. I was going to go that route when we decided to get our wood stove. I thought the less problems the EPA threw my way, the better. I just don't need them. Well, I got to looking, and we eventually bought an EPA stove. And folks, I'm happy that I did. That increase in efficiency means that I am getting a lot more heat out of the hunks of wood that I sweat to cut down and sweat to split and sweat to carry inside the house. I'm getting a lot more heat out of that because it's actually burning the gases and the whatever fuel is in the smoke. When my stove is up to temperature, I can walk outside and look up at my chimney, and there's absolutely nothing coming out of the chimney. Nothing. You can see a little bit of the heat mirage to let you know that the thing is going, but there is no smoke at all. I think that's pretty cool because I'm getting the most out of that stove. And even in EPA stoves, there's two directions to go. You can go with a catalytic EPA stove or a non-catalytic, non-cat, they call them. The catalytic stoves are essentially, they have a catalytic converter like is in your car. It's a matrix. It's a honeycomb of a very expensive metal that once it gets hot, it helps to burn the flammable gases that would otherwise go up the chimney. And it's very good at it. You get a lot of extra heat out. The other way that people make stoves to pass the EPA standards are to add combustion air inside the stove itself. They are not quite as efficient. However, that catalytic converter, that catalyst, needs to be replaced every so often. Now, granted, it's not every year. It's more like every 4, 5, 6 years, depending on how clean the stuff you're burning. But that's just an expense, and that's something that I didn't want to deal with down the road. So my particular stove is a soapstone stove that's non-catalytic, and it's got a big glass front, and frankly, I couldn't be happier with it. The other type of wood stove that is very popular, at least around here, is the outdoor wood boiler. Now, this is the first sort of a detour away from the heating sources that I've been talking about so far, in that an outdoor wood boiler requires electricity. So these outdoor wood boilers look like a little garden shed with a little chimney coming out the top, and you know, some of them have a 1 foot chimney, some of them have a 5 or 6 foot chimney. Usually the chimneys are pretty short. They're set away from the house. They are essentially a big wood stove with a lot of water coils around them. It's actually more of an antifreeze that goes through the coils. And that fluid, that antifreeze, gets pumped into the house. And there's a radiator inside the house, and you're ducted, you know, your forced air system, and there's a fan behind the radiator, and the fan blows the air across the radiator that takes the heat out of the fluid and warms your house. Or some folks have thought ahead when they were building their house, and they have hydronic systems, that is, little coils of fluid tubes underneath their floors, and so the pump just pumps that hot water through those coils and you get heat from the floor coming up. It does take some electricity to move that warm fluid. How much? You know, I've read articles where somebody said, well, it's essentially the same as a 75 watt bulb going all the time. So, I'm not sure that if it's practical for a generator for long term, but certainly that seems to be within the realm of a renewable energy system, if one were to go that route. The wood boilers do have a lot of advantages going for them. You don't have to worry about chimney fires. The thing is, 50 feet away, and the chimney's only 10 feet tall anyway, so if it wants to light up, then let it rip. They usually have a very big wood box, so you can fill that sucker once per day. Once every 24 hours, you go out and put half a tree in there. And there's little sensors that decide how much air to let in. If the water is hot and you're not using it inside the house, it'll cool things off by not blowing as much combustion air into it. It's really a neat system and it's really efficient. But once again, in my mind, it does depend on electricity. One of the advantages of it as well is most folks tie it into their domestic hot water. So the hot water for showers or for doing the dishes or whatever, you get that from the same system as well. So it's really nice to have limitless hot water that way. Last on my list, I've put down coal stoves. These are essentially the same as wood-burning stoves, except they are built to a little bit heavier standard. Coal burns hotter and longer than wood, so please don't throw a shovel full of coal into your wood stove. It'll work great until it melts your stove because it's not built for it. Now, there are some dual-fuel stoves. There are some coal stoves that will also burn wood, and that will be just fine. Some of the advantages of coal, as I mentioned, is it burns longer and it does burn hotter, so you don't need to use as much mass, right? You don't need to use a bushel basket of wood, half of that or a quarter of that volume in coal would provide the same amount of heat. Coal doesn't go bad. Even wood, if you store it outside and you've let it sit for years, it will be rotten and it will be not super good to try and extract heat from by burning. Coal's been under the ground for a long time, and if you put it above the ground, it'll probably last longer than you will. So there's an advantage there. However, I am not sure I would like to explain to my in-town neighbors my giant coal pile in the backyard. I'm afraid if neighbor kids came over to play, they would go home and moms would have something to say about that. Whereas a wood pile in town, is stacked neatly. I guess unless you have a restrictive homeowners association, you might be able to get away with that. There's all kinds of other considerations when we're looking at backup heat sources. We need to factor in the cost of the appliance. A kerosene heater is certainly going to cost a lot less than a new wood stove. The cost of the fuel as well. Although that kerosene heater is relatively inexpensive, at $4.50 a gallon of fuel, it adds up pretty quick. Whereas I like to fool myself and think that my time is free spent in the woods with a chainsaw and a splitting maul and that kind of stuff. The fuel storage and longevity we have to worry about. I kind of hinted on that earlier, talking about the coal versus wood. Kerosene will eventually go bad, as will diesel. LP and coal probably will not. Natural gas, we don't have complete control over it. Somebody brings that to us. Convenience, it's certainly a lot more convenient if you have natural gas to hook up a vent-free heater, and there you're set. No power, and you don't have to worry about how much natural gas is in your tank. It's super convenient. On the other hand, you know, as I mentioned before, you don't control who you have no control over that gas getting to you. Finally, if we are looking at heating our home on sort of an emergency basis, we might want to decrease the area that we are going to heat. For instance, my friend put his Blue Flame heater in a certain section of the basement. That section of the basement happened to be where all the piping was. And although it was unfinished and it certainly wasn't a posh residence, he had a cots down there and he had all kinds of amenities, so if the power went out in our cold Wisconsin winters, he would be, you know, not in style, but he would certainly be plenty warm, and he had some food stocked up, and that was certainly a good way to maximize the small amount of heat that his heater put out. The other thing you can do is decrease the temperature that you're comfortable with. You know, your pipes only need to be above 32 to keep them from freezing, as do the things in your pantry and all that other kind of stuff. So if you can only keep your house at 45 degrees, which is pretty darn cold, but you know, if you wear jackets and big thick slippers inside the house, it's doable. It'll make your fuel last longer. It's not as much work. You can probably keep a larger area 45 degrees than you can 85 degrees. Finally, no talk about heating stuff would be complete without a little bit of talk about safety as well. I have tried to sprinkle in here suggestions about smoke alarms, fire extinguishers, and CO detectors. And folks, these are good ideas to have now. You know, the odds of the Earth getting hit by a comet are infinitesimal. The odds of any one of us having a house fire are certainly much higher. So, you know, my suggestion is to put a little bit more time in things that are more probable. Get some big fire extinguishers, some 5 or 10 pounders, not the little spray can looking ones, and stash them all over your house, in every closet, and make sure the kids know how to get out of the house if there's a fire, and what to do when the smoke alarms go off, and all that other kind of fun stuff. Same thing with the CO detectors. Don't stand around wondering if it's a false alarm. Do something about it. At least get the kids out while you're opening up windows. Practice some smart fuel storage as well. You know, we don't really want to store those 100-pound LP tanks in our basement. You know, we certainly, although kerosene is fairly stable, we certainly don't want to have 50 or 100 gallons of that sitting in the garage, you know, next to our smoking chair or whatever. Safety first, folks, and we'll all live to see Bob back on the podcast. Thanks very much for your patience, guys. I sure appreciate it. Again, this is not my cup of tea. I am not a good public speaker, but I appreciate you staying with me. And to Bob, thank you very much, sir, for the opportunity, and I hope to hear you instead of me soon. Bye-bye, folks.